This episode of Hookup Horror Stories is brought to you by Podmatch. Do you have a podcast that could use some fresh guests? Or perhaps you're an entrepreneur and are looking to get featured on cool podcasts? Never fear, Podmatch is here. Podmatch is an online podcast matching service that automatically matches ideal podcast hosts and guests for interviews. Imagine your favorite online dating app, but instead of using it for finding dates, you're booking podcast interviews. Simply make your account, fill out your bio, add your keywords on what you're looking for, and get matched with Podmatch's automatic matching technology. I've been using Podmatch for a few years now to book guests, and I absolutely love it. I find really cool people, coaches, experts, and gurus on all sorts of topics. And of course, today's guest I found on Podmatch. I also get booked on other people's shows all the time, and I have a blast meeting people from all over and creating long-lasting relationships with them. Sign up today using my affiliate link at joinpodmatch.com/DimitriWild. That's joinpodmatch.com/DimitriWild. And check this episode description for more. Welcome to Hookup Horror Stories. This podcast contains topics that may not be suitable for listeners under the age of 18. This includes things like domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexuality. They are intended to be educational in nature, but either way, a trigger warning is in place. Listener discretion is advised.
Incredible. It has done so much for me in terms of helping me actively listen, because I don't have to think about what I'm going to say. I can just be present to what they're sharing, what they're experiencing. And no matter what it is, I can just share with them that I'm grateful that they've allowed me to be present for it. And so all I have to do is say, thank you for sharing, and then just sit there with it and allow the process of them kind of working through what they need to work through, allow me the time and space to work through what I need to work through too, because ultimately self-regulation is an incredibly important thing in this moment. But the slide in that pussy is a homicide. But the slide in that pussy is the homicide. It's the homicide.
Welcome to Hookup Horror Stories, the podcast where we spill the tea on sex and dating. I'm your resident sexual deviant, Demi Wild. And today I've got a very special guest deviant for you today. Author of the book, When Your Partner Says Me Too, Your Role and Responsibilities in the Recovery Process, Sean Hamilton. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Demi. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you being here. Sean, can you let us know a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, let's see. I'm a Navy veteran. I served in the Navy, kind of the submarine community, working on nuclear reactors for, you know, a number of years.
Whoa, that's so cool.
Yeah, so I mean, that was a crazy part of my life for sure. It feels like a completely different life in terms of what I'm doing now. But yeah, it was crazy to wake up next to, you know, kind of nuclear missiles and then go to work on a nuclear reactor at 1,000 feet below the ocean. It was just, I woke up many days being like, how the fuck is this my life? But, yeah, it's crazy. But so now I'm just doing something completely different, but still with the same kind of devotion and passion that I did, and sense of duty and, you know, trying to serve others. So yeah, it's kind of where I'm at now, is really in the realm of, you know, gender violence, sexual assault prevention, kind of being an activist and a voice to kind of just raise my hand and be counted, just because, you know, I'm not a survivor myself, but I've been in enough relationships now with people who have survived, you know, just a different kind of just smattering of stories in terms of what they've had to go through. And it's just put me on a path that I just can't be silent about it anymore.
I completely agree. And thank you for being a man, first of all, and stepping up and actually discussing these things openly. It's so important for men, and especially straight men, partners of people who have been victims and survivors, to actually stand up and be heard as well, to help lend your voice.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that I hope that I can inspire more partners through, you know, kind of reading my book and kind of engaging with the content that I create to just start feeling ready to tell their side of the story too, because our side as partners is relevant in this conversation, as you know, as we'll, I'm sure, talk about, but it's just so needed in a desert of content that just doesn't exist. That's what I found so disheartening when I started trying to figure out what my role is and how was I supposed to react and respond when, my girlfriend, my now wife, she was assaulted 2 weeks after we started dating. And when I started kind of looking for help, I was just blown away that there just wasn't anything that talked about this issue from the perspective of somebody that's kind of shoulder to shoulder with the survivor through the recovery process. And, you know, that just kind of led me to do what I'm doing now.
Yeah, completely. I will. Let's take a pin in that really quick, because I do want to come back to that for sure. But I do want to ask you about this nuclear this nuclear thing you were working on as a vet.
I'm just
very interested in this. How did that, first of all, where are you from originally? How did you grow up? And then how did that lead you into the veteran work that you did?
Yeah, so I'm from Texas originally, Dallas. And you know, my grandfather was a Navy vet too. He actually was stationed at Pearl Harbor on the day that it got attacked.
Wow.
And made it through. He was, you know, miraculously kind of on leave. And he was just on another island when the whole thing went down and then ran over. And, you know, it was a really huge trauma in his life for sure. But it was a sense of connection, really, because I didn't get to know him. He died about 6 months after I was born, and I never really got to know him. But through, you know, through different aspects of my life and how my dad raised me, I got to know him a little bit. And then, you know, when I found out that he had joined the Navy and served, it just kind of hit me all at once. A friend of mine came and was like, "Hey, I'm thinking about joining the service." I was at a time in my life where I was just knew that I needed discipline in my life. I knew I needed something to change kind of what was going on. And so I just went in and decided to take the entrance test. And they were like, "We want to make you a nuclear operator. Do you want to work on a submarine?" And I was like, "Oh, that sounds really awesome." Like the idea of it sounded really badass and really kind of like, whoa, like completely different than what I was doing. And so I was like, "Okay, let's do it." And went in and found myself, you know, a year and a half later, being like, "Oh, this was completely different than I thought what it was going to be." And yeah, it was one of the most challenging times of my life, and yet had some of the best experiences. I got to surf on the top of a submarine, which was crazy. Coming into the Straits of Juan de Fuca, like the mountaintops all around. It's, you know, sunset. It's kind of raining and drizzling. We got the flag flying on the back, and you're, you know, basically like this very narrow path on the top of the submarine as it's kind of surfaced, kind of cruising through. And, you know, my job as an electrician, I had to come up and prepare the boat to kind of take on power once we got to port. But we just had to stand on top. And as we were cruising through, you're just like on this very narrow path, just getting to kind of have an experience that's like, when else in the world am I ever going to get a chance to surf on the top of the submarine as it's coming through this mountaintop and bald eagles are flying over us? I mean, it was the craziest, like, most like American thing I could feel. Like at that time, it was just like, yeah, it was pretty intense.
That sounds dope. I would love to have that experience.
yeah, it was cool. I mean, it made up for, you know, it made up for all the times where you're up for 96 hours straight, you know, getting yelled at and just, you know, living in an incredibly stressful environment. But right. You know, there's those moments of, you know, just absolute wonder and awe that you're just like, how the fuck is this my life? Like, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, it's crazy. But yeah, it was cool.
I feel like there's also been a lot of, this is completely off topic, but like I feel like there's a lot of talk, especially with like the war in Ukraine and Russia, and now kind of like these whispers of like China wanting to, like, you know, causing issues with the US. Do you, this is pure conjecture perhaps, but do you feel as though there might be an ever-present nuclear danger just with your experience?
Well, I think with the presence of, you know, with the fact that there are nuclear arms out there, and, you know, and a lot of them, there's always going to be, you know, that threat. There's always going to be the real and present danger that, you know, some sort of, you know, country pushes you know, some other country to the brink of feeling as threatened as possible. And this is the only way out of it. And we, you know, also there's the threat that, you know, some sort of rogue actors get their hands on some sort of kind of dirty bomb material. And, you know, that's a real present threat that, that exists in a day and age like we have now. I don't know that it's something that I, you know, spend too much of my time worried about with the safety precautions that, that are there. But you know, we live in a day and age where who knows what's going to happen when we get, you know, emotionally unstable leaders in positions of power, you know, and that includes our own country, right? I mean, we're the only country to have ever dropped one. So, you know, to be super afraid that other countries are going to do it, I feel like discounts history a little bit in terms of, you know, our willingness to
part in it,
to do
yeah.
that as well. So, but yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, you know, I think that the deterrent exists for a reason. You know, I know that that my role and my job was to be out there, kind of secret and hidden, just, you know, basically keeping other people that have those weapons kind of in a mutually assured destruction position, where it's like, you know, what keeps them from launching is understanding that, you know, they can launch one and we can, you know, launch many, many more, you know, aim directly at them. And so that's, it's just unfortunate that humanity has organized itself to be in this position. And hopefully, you know, we can create some sort of arrangement to mitigate and reduce that. But yeah, I think with the rise in tensions around the world, it is something that, you know, is a concern in terms of, you know, if we get to an all out full scale world war again, you know, and the situation in Ukraine seems to be a potential catalyst for that. You know, no one's got a crystal ball to see how that's going to play out. But, you know, hopefully it doesn't go there, you know, hopefully it doesn't, because that would be a world that none of us really want to see and live in, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Switching gears here just a tad, just a little bit. I do want to talk about your wife's experience, and I hope I have her blessing in asking these questions. I feel as though it's a very important topic, and especially as partners of people who might have had these situations happen to them. What can you tell me about what happened to her, and how did you support her in that experience?
Yeah. So, like I said, 2 weeks after we started dating, she got sexually assaulted by kind of a quote friend of hers who had been in her life for a while. He and his wife were like a pretty big part of the core group of friends that she was hanging around at that time. Unfortunately, he was just a sociopath. Like, he was just somebody that used a self-diagnosis of Asperger's to hide creepy behavior. And then utilized kind of exploiting his wife to use her as a shield, to where he had kind of conditioned her to use that same kind of shield of that Asperger's diagnosis, so that when he would meet new people and he would do these kind of real red flag type of behaviors that would cross boundaries, and he would just consistently do that all the time, the friend group was really like, oh, you know, they've already discounted it. Oh, he's just, you know, he's in that category of having kind of special needs, but, you know, he's very functional and, you know, and social, very interested. Right. Exactly. And it just put it in a place in people's mind that they didn't really think too much about it. However, what it got them to do is just kind of look past a lot of the red flags that other people that would come into the situation, not having that kind of, you know, that background on him and that self-diagnosis, they would come in and be like, this dude is like real, real creepy. And he's just doing some kind of behaviors. Well, it turns out that, he had actually sexually assaulted six or seven other women in the friend group. And when my wife was assaulted, she decided she was going to be the last one. And it was a really difficult thing because they were, you know, he and his wife were at the time like really good friends of hers. And it was just this massive explosion within the friend group. And six or seven of them all got together and decided, you know, my wife was like leading charge. We went to criminal court, we went to civil court, you know, filed a sexual assault restraining order. And I was just there shoulder to shoulder through the process of her being let down time and time again by the justice system. And also got to bear witness to the trauma that a survivor goes through going through this process that you're supposed to go through, right? Like there's this conversation around this topic where a survivor is required in order to be believed to go through this certain process. And that process is you file a police report, you get a rape kit done, you go to the hospital, you get all of the evidence, and you start telling your story over and over and over and over to all of these different people within the authority system. And right, exactly. No one's really stopping to really consider what it's like at the very beginning when the trauma is fresh, what it's like to talk about any type of trauma, right? Like if we looked at PTSD from any type of trauma, like a combat veteran, right after they've been through trauma, if they had to sit down and get over and over and over and over and over while being like scrutinized, being kind of made to feel like you're lying about the situation the whole time by all of these different types of people, like we could understand that's a really traumatic thing for somebody to go through. But then you put it in the context of somebody's like intimate and sex life and these personal things that have happened to them. Like no one really likes to talk about their personal intimate details of their sex life anyway. That's not something that society is really that comfortable with. And yet when we combine the two and we put sexual trauma together, it just becomes this nightmare of an issue where survivors' experiences are invalidated while no one's really being compassionate for what the experience is like to be abused, not believed, and then have a system completely betray you at every level while requiring you to relive your trauma over and over and over and over. And a lot of times it's in circumstances and environments in which they're not feeling safe. I mean, one of the craziest things that I experienced just in this whole thing was sitting in the courtroom and there's no, you know, they make it seem like it's this way on TV where there's this bailiff, where there's this, you know, guy with a gun and everyone feels safe. And the perpetrator who's been accused is like walked in and they're separated and they're on opposite sides of the courtroom. And there's all these people, you know, keeping it safe. Well, that's not how it is at all. Like you walk in and it's like just this row of pews, like you're sitting in church and like one, you know, the abuser is sitting in the pew right in front of you. There's no bailiff at all anywhere. There's no security. There's nothing except the guy that just abused you and you're sitting behind them with your lawyer and he's sitting there with his lawyer. And it's just this, like, he could literally turn around and put hands on you. And it's like, that is the craziest situation. And it's like so ripe for more trauma to happen because I got to tell you, the level of self-control that not only me, but my wife's brother, who is also a veteran and a Marine, the level of self-control that we had sitting in that courtroom when we could have put hands on him, like super, like just real easy. It was like, so not only is like the survivor safety like not considered, but like the intensity of the emotions that are felt in this particular kind of crime, they're not considering what the rest of us are feeling as well as having to like sit here and like stare at this dude that's caused so much harm and abuse and like how much control it takes us to not jump over this pew and beat the ever living shit out of this guy. Like it was just like, how is the court system set up and organized? Like it was just, it's bonkers, man. It's like, and it just failed at so many levels. So, you know, the King County Prosecutor's Office ended up dropping the case, you know, against this dude that seven girls came forward to file charges of, you know, that he had, you know, used and abused them in different ways. And it was just like, you know, it was just really fucked up. But yeah, so.
Did any other witnesses come, any other victim survivors come forward?
Yeah, seven other girls had come forward. Wow. And filed, you know, public statements in reference to what my wife's case was. And, you know, and then the prosecutor's office dropped the case because it wasn't a winnable case. And this is, I think, one of the biggest issues and the conflicts of interest we have when our justice system deals with these things is because the people who are bringing this court case for punishment, it's not just, you know, it's not just a regular lawyer in that criminal case. It's somebody who has a career trajectory that they're keeping in mind. So they're trying to keep their record unblemished. So they won't actually do their job because they're afraid that they may not, you know, get the next position they're up for because they lost a case. So they're not even like going to go through the process of doing it. And
right.
you know, it sucks because the whole process is traumatic no matter what. So there's just a no-win situation for survivors where the entire system seems set up to protect the abuser, right? They're innocent. The abuser from day one, from the time he commits this rape or sexual assault, he's innocent in terms of the system's eyes. He's innocent until he's proven guilty. Where the survivor, they're a liar until they prove that they're telling the truth. And the overwhelming abundance of, you know, evidence that's needed for the court system to see them as telling the truth is unfortunately in these particular types of crimes so unlikely to get. And even when they do get it, the court system seems to have a decision-making process that doesn't hold people accountable. And that's completely fucked. And it's heartbreaking, you know, not only to have experienced it kind of firsthand, but to know that millions of other survivors out there and their families and their partners and everybody else that's kind of in their nuclear, orbit didn't, you know, went through the same kind of traumatic process of, you know, I can't even imagine what the woman felt like. Oh, the Brock Turner case, if you're familiar with that one,
I've heard of
where
it,
he was caught red-handed, like by two eyewitnesses, pull him off of her unconscious, laying behind a dumpster. And the dude is only given 6 months in prison and then let out 3 months early on quote, good behavior. I can't imagine the level of re-traumatization that not only having your case be that public, but like for the court system to let you down that bad. It's crazy how those little moments, they just create an environment that there's just no real deterrent for a crime. Like if we considered it in any other crime, like if I could go out and I could steal a car today and I get caught red-handed by two eyewitnesses stealing this car, and I'm not going to really do any time because the stats say, well, 97 to 98% of the people that are caught, accused, and even convicted of this crime will never see a day in jail. How many more cars do you think are getting stolen? Like, it's crazy that we just don't have a deterrent for this type of crime when it's, you know, it's portrayed in the media as like this really huge, awful, horrible thing, right? That we create television shows and there's, you know, Detective Stabler and Olivia are out there trying to save us, and Ice-T's kicking down doors, keeping these predators off the streets, when in reality, that feels so far from the truth in terms of the experience of what it's like to be, in the camp of a survivor and having gone through this whole process.
So other than, you know, going through this whole process of the legal system and everything with your wife, what other strains on the relationship did this take?
Well, all the kind of interpersonal, emotional, intimate strains. Like, this isn't the first time that I went through this situation. My first girlfriend in high school was also kind of a victim of abuse and sexual assault. And so I kind of knew when my wife was assaulted 2 weeks into us dating, that there was, you know, a really high likelihood that our relationship actually wasn't even going to work out. Like that she was just going to push me away. She was going to be so emotionally and physically distant because of just how the trauma was. It's like, I have no idea how she's going to really respond to this. And there was a time where she started to kind of push me away and from her side, it was more so like, she just didn't want to put me through that. Didn't want me, you know, she didn't want to, one, be seen by that. You know, there's a lot of guilt and shame that survivors deal with. And so she just didn't want to put me through that scenario. And so there was a lot of that at the very beginning of like really trying to feel like, hey, I'm not someone that's just going to leave you high and dry here, you know, going through this whole situation by yourself. You know, we've been friends for 4 years before we even started dating. So it wasn't like, this wasn't, even if not, it's not like I'm just this person that's just going to like leave you, you know, alone in a crisis like this, you know, like even if we have to back off and we're no longer dating, like as a friend, as another human being, like I want to help you in any way that I can. But like, you know, as a person that's still trying to develop an emotional and intimate attachment and connection, it's challenging, you know, it's a really difficult time in somebody's life who's recovering from this type of thing to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel that they can trust themselves, they can feel they can trust others, you know. So all of these things are just shattered that are really important when it comes to building a relationship. And so to rebuild all of that is re- really, really hard. And it's not an easy thing to do. But it's so worth it in the long run, because of how important and dramatic of an impact the partner and somebody that's like right there close to them can make on their healing environment. And, you know, so a little bit more specific to your question than kind of abstract is that, you know, the intimate life and sexual life is really challenging, because the most, what I call in the book, it's called the worst case scenario, is like when you're with somebody in a sexual situation, you're, you know, sexual activity, and they get triggered by something, and you were kind of going down this road of like, you know, heightened arousal, everything's going well, you're kind of marching towards this orgasm, you know, everyone's, you know, kind of in that state of mind, everything's really moving in a positive direction. And then all of a sudden, anything, right? A sight, a sound, a smell, a memory, a flashback, anything that can occur, you know, can occur. It creates a heightened sense of adrenaline, which can then spiral them out. And all of a sudden they're in a completely different world of, you know, PTSD and panic attack and crying and tears and rolling over, you know, kind of hugging themselves in a fetal position, don't want to be touched, don't want anything near or around them. And as a partner, it's really challenging, because it's like, you know, from a survivor, they're dealing with so much more. I just wanted to say that in terms of the context of this, but from a partner's perspective, it's really, really challenging, because the swing that we are having to go through too is like, we were just kind of marching towards this incredibly orgasmic, euphoric moment. And in a drop of a dime, we're in a completely different scenario. And yet at the same time, it's not that all of your emotions exist in a vacuum separate from one another. So it's like all of a sudden, like you're still in a state of arousal, and yet you have all of these stacked emotions of, you know, worry and anger and rage and resentment and, you know, disappointment and frustration, and all of these emotions stack on top of all of these other ones that you're still having to self-regulate and pull yourself out of this sense of arousal and expectation. And, you know, it's a cluster. And that, you know, that was something that was real. That was not something abstract in my life. That's something I faced on many, many, many occasions. And so that's what, you know, when I was looking for information, you know, of course, there's not a lot of information out there even around sexual violence itself. And most of it is like clinical and written by doctors in a completely different language. They're writing for a different audience. And so they're not really writing for the layman. They're not writing for you and me and people that are like dealing with this on a deck plate kind of level. So it's not really approachable. It's not really like accessible in terms of information that's really like speaking to somebody's experience. And so that's why I just felt compelled to like put together a lot of information, was in the aftermath of dealing with all of those like kind of intimate struggles and those like real moment kind of sexual activity pivots that happen in the midst of, you know, kind of a trauma response. Like, how do we talk as raw and as real about that moment as we can? Because it's that moment that is so critical to a survivor's healing recovery process. Because if we really understand what that moment is it's exposure therapy. And in any other context on the planet and any kind of other traumas that's going on, we require doctorate level education. We require incredible amounts of experience and licenses that are like regulated by the state, you know, in order to walk somebody through that level of high stakes exposure therapy. Like, there's a lot of, you know, responsibility of that. And yet in this particular case, when it comes to the only way that a survivor really gets that level of exposure therapy is to reengage their intimacy and sex life. And so their partner is going to play the role of that therapist that's going to be there in those moments where, boom, all this stuff comes to the surface. And it's not like we have a crystal ball that tells us, well, this is going to be the day, this is going to be the moment, get prepared. It's like, no, you're having to think on your feet in a matter of, you know, literally milliseconds of like, wow, I have a moment right here where I'm either going to keep them on a path of healing, or I'm going to make a decision that continues to further cause harm and further ingrain the trauma and the guilt and the shame spirals that they could be in. And how do we prepare ourselves to deal with that when, you know, the system, you know, there isn't really any education out there. And so yeah, that was one of the big challenges that I faced as a survivor's partner, is just like, how do I handle this moment?
Yeah. And I don't honestly think a lot of people would stick around, which I think is actually really, it speaks to you as a person, as a, in your character. So that's actually really amazing. I do want to add that I think what I want to accomplish with how you're speaking about like how people survive, and what I want to do with this and with this work that I've been found myself in, is to actually just change the conversation around it and make it okay to talk about it. Make it, sometimes this stuff can be funny, but sometimes it could be really serious too. So like, just change the conversation around it and just like be open to having conversations about your intimacy life, and just the more you share, the easier it is. And it's a human experience. We're all having the same human experience, and
for sure
there's value in that.
Completely agree. Yeah. No, I it's funny that you say change the conversation, because I just made this piece of content and released it on Instagram today, where I made this like big billboard thing and it said changing the conversation, because that's a huge kind of motto for me around this content, is to really try and change the conversation around a lot of things, because there's so much, you know, kind of misinformation and pigeonholes where people get boxed into, you know, political ideology before they even come to this conversation with an open mind about the evidence when it comes to any particular part of the issue. And so we just have to really, you know, do a lot of work, you know, kind of from, you know, our perspectives in terms of making content, is really about changing the conversation. It's about really trying to help people get out of, you know, some of the frameworks that they may have developed in terms of how they are processing this information. Yeah, I think that's really important.
Definitely. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about your book, and then I know you have a story for us. And we're back. I'm back here with Sean Hamilton. He is the author of the book, When Your Partner Says Me Too, Your Role and Responsibilities in the Recovery Process. I wanted to talk about this book because it's, we've been having this conversation about partners of people who have survived sexual assault. And I wanted to know how this book came into existence and what are some like key things people can take away from it.
Yeah. So I wrote this book because it was I wanted to write the book that my 15-year-old self could have read the first time I was going through this. I was like fresh in high school when I fell in love for the first time. And in that process, in that relationship, a lot of, you know, my girlfriend's traumas from her past started bubbling up. And it was the first time I was really exposed to this issue. And at that point in time, there wasn't anything. There wasn't social media. The internet really wasn't like this huge thing where you could go and tons of resources were available. And when I found myself, you know, kind of on the front lines of it again, you know, so many years later, even when I went trying to find resources, there just wasn't any resources, and especially no resources for people in my position being a partner of a survivor. And so it really came about after my wife and I had kind of been through the recovery process, kind of got through the acute stages of all of the trauma, you know, made it through a lot of the, you know, triggering events in our intimacy, kind of bringing sex back into our life, and, you know, kind of managing and dealing with that. She went through and got really great effective therapy through, you know, the community of rapid resolution therapists. And that is a modality that I will scream from the rooftops until the day I die. It's one of the most incredible forms of therapy that anybody can get.
What was it called again?
It's called rapid resolution therapy. RRT
therapy.
Yeah. It was developed by a Dr. John Connolly, who also founded the Institute for Survivors of Sexual Violence. And he's just been doing rapid resolution therapy for a really long time. And it, you know, it utilizes a lot of hypnotherapy, neuro-linguistic programming, and a real heightened focus on how we use our words and the intentionality that we use our words and the specificity that words can have on our subconscious and our ability to process information. And my wife, Kristen Rivas, she has a TED talk that she did in 2013 about rapid resolution therapy's impact on her life. Because, you know, before all of the trauma that we faced together, she lost her sister to a drunk driver, and the traumatic grief caused an incredible breakdown in her neurological system. You know, she was suffering seizures up to 9 times a day, narcolepsy, Tourette syndrome, all sorts of neurological dysfunction. She was a patient of the Mayo Clinic for 2 years. She was in a wheelchair wearing a helmet. She had to drop out of college. She basically just lost all of her life because of this. And the Mayo Clinic, all the doctors and nurses didn't really know what to do. Everything they tried, every modality and protocol just made her symptoms worse, exacerbating the symptoms and everything. And then she went for one session of rapid resolution therapy. And in 1 2.5 hour session, she's been seizure free and symptom free ever since. And so she went immediately and trained under him and has been a mental health therapist now for almost 15 years, working with thousands of people from all over the world, helping them reduce and get out of suffering from whatever they have kind of been through life. And so it's a absolute something I think that people can get out of this book is just the connection to rapid resolution therapy, because there's so much about therapy that I feel like the conditioning process is a lot of people may not approach therapy because of the length of time that we have kind of placed on this idea. All the media around it is like, oh, we go and we sit in a therapist's office for years and years and years of our life, hoping to move the needle just a little bit on, you know, just one of the things we've been through in life. But most of us have been through so much stuff that it feels overwhelming to even think about approaching therapy. It doesn't feel accessible because not only the money that it would take to go to therapy for that amount of time, but you know, the outcomes may not be, we may not be getting those outcomes as quickly and as conveniently as we want. And so just screaming from the rooftops that there is a modality out there that's providing really incredible results for people in a very short and fast and effective kind of time is something I'm really passionate about.
That's an amazing thing. Quick results. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
For sure.
Cool. So again, what are some other key things that we can take away from this, like just to support our partners, like in this process?
Yeah, I think there was 3 things that I write about in the book because I wanted it to be accessible to people. I didn't want to create a list of like 92 things and make it seem like it's all super easy. So there's 3 things that I talk about in the book that really helped me approach the worst case scenario, because if we can, as partners, prepare and plan for the worst case scenario, which is basically what I've kind of coined the like Olympic event of emotional intelligence response in terms of being able to understand and process how we're feeling in the moment when we're having sex and somebody has a PTSD reaction, like the amount of emotional intelligence that requires somebody to have is like, how do we process our own emotions and what we're feeling? How do we process the emotions of this person that's sitting with me? And then how do we navigate the complete cluster of emotions that exist and that are present here? Because we have to self-regulate ourselves out of this sense of arousal, deal with the frustration and disappointment that this, you know, moment isn't going to end in this orgasmic bliss, but rather it's going to end in very challenging and uncomfortable conversations. And we didn't have any warning that that was going to happen. So we have to navigate that moment in a very, very short amount of time. So if we can approach that moment and learn, you know, some skill sets to really help us do that, then, you know, a lot of the other things that kind of come up and challenging in our relationships, we're already also prepared for because these skill sets are kind of applicable to those as well. So I would say that the first thing is, it sounds simplistic, but it's just be there. And what that means is kind of, we have to tune in our active listening skills. We have to be able to hear somebody's trauma and not feel like we have to fix it right now. We have a tendency to maybe drown out people who are sharing challenging things with us when we jump into fix it mode right away. And it's really hard. It's really hard not to, because when you hear somebody that you love and care about struggling and going through something, you want to make it better. You want to make it okay. You want to make them feel better. You feel like, oh my gosh, like I can't sit in this awkward silence because I feel like I have to say something. And then the tendency is to like just make up something on the spot, especially when it's this incredibly intense emotional experience. And maybe this is the first time you've ever been through it. And it's like, how do I navigate that? And what I've found is using the phrase, thank you for sharing, is incredible. It has done so much for me in terms of helping me actively listen, because I don't have to think about what I'm going to say. I can just be present to what they're sharing, what they're experiencing. And no matter what it is, I can just share with them that I'm grateful that they've allowed me to be present for it. And so all I have to do is say, thank you for sharing, and then just sit there with it and allow the process of them kind of working through what they need to work through, allow me the time and space to work through what I need to work through too, because ultimately self-regulation is a, is an incredibly important thing in this moment. And so, yeah, the first thing is just be there and actively listen and use that phrase, thank you for sharing. And that's it. You don't have to add anything else at that moment, in that moment of like regulating yourself out of all those heightened emotions and your arousal, if that's the case, if that's, you know, kind of the moment you're in. The second is about making space. It sounds easy, and all of these things sound easy, but I promise you, in the context of this particular situation, it's incredibly challenging. But making space is about understanding the emotional space that's needed, as well as the physical space that's needed. And unfortunately, I can't give you like a specific about it, because it's all up to the individual survivor who's like going through the situation. It's up to you, as you know, well as the partner, to kind of find that, what I call like the Goldilocks period, where it's like, we don't want to be, you know, in this moment of PTSD and kind of triggering experience. We don't want to just like be all over them, smothering them in terms of physical space, right? But we also don't want to just bounce out of the room right away and leave them alone, like just to experience it for themselves either, unless they've requested that. Of course, if they request that, then that may be what they need. But finding that kind of Goldilocks place where it might be just move to the other side of the couch and just be with them to let them know that you're still here with them, that this isn't, you know, you're not running away from their trauma and their pain. You know, because the guilt and shame spirals are something that's challenging to manage in that moment. And so we have to let them know that we're here, but not smother them at the same time. And so that's why I kind of consider it that like Goldilocks place, where we got to find that like perfect balance of, you know, not too much space physically and not too much, you know, too little space by smothering them. Right. While at the same time, the emotional space is something that, you know, is also needs to be considered, is where that kind of ties into the just being there and actively listening, is like the emotional space is created by allowing them the time and the space to cry if they need to fucking be mad if they need to say whatever emotions are coming up, to really identify how they're feeling, why they're feeling it, you know, really identifying what triggered them into this moment, because that's important for, you know, a couple and a, you know, in a relationship to really process, is to start building a database of like, what are the things about the particular experience of trauma that they went through? Like they're the ones with that really unique trauma that happened to them that only they understand and had experienced. Well, their triggers are going to be, you know, something in that space related to what happened. And so identifying those are really important, and making the emotional space to be able to allow that time to process and make that available is really important as well. So it's about just being there, actively listening, making that space. And the third one that helped my wife and I tremendously is called checking in. And checking in is a time I talk about in the book about how we as partners need time outside of the relationship to heal some of the energy, you know, the negativity, all of this kind of stuff we take on as kind of secondary trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need to be able to heal that outside of the relationship. Well, our relationship also needs moments outside of the tension that's created in these moments to really address some of the things that neither happened, or how do we prevent things from happening in the future, developing a plan and a strategy for things that may occur in the future. And so checking in was something that was super huge for my wife and I. We actually set a time on Sundays to like sit down and literally go through every little category of our relationship in terms of like friends. Are we doing things that we, you know, continue to make us laugh and go out like we weren't dating? You know, are we going to just do fun things together? Then like roommate stuff, you know, when we move in together, hey, we cohabitate, there's these roommate things. And then it came down to kind of our intimate life, our sex life, and being lovers. Is it really gave us an opportunity to really check in around her trauma, what came up in therapy, you know, what came up in the last like week or two that, you know, we could actually use some movement on and go to therapy for. You know, it just helps us identify a lot of what's happened in a context that isn't so heightened emotionally. Because if we're trying to handle it all in the moments that like the triggering happens in a, you know, in a sexual activity, like that's going to be really, really hard for, I think, any relationship to sustain the real work that needs to get done if it's all being handled under that really heightened emotion. And so if we can schedule some times in our relationship to kind of check in and do that when it's not emotionally like an emergency, it's really beneficial and valuable.
I agree. And I think the key to any long-term relationship is that checking in. I've heard so many people talk about it. Just, I remember hearing this, I believe it was an older couple, and they were talking about how they check in with each other. They actually just like give each other a number of like 1 to 10 of the day. Mm. And like that's where you are emotionally for that day. And it's like, okay, you know, you're at a 4 today. Let's go do some different things, you know, give you some little bit of space. Yeah. And you're at 10, let's go to the movie. You know, it's that simple. It can be that simple.
For sure. Yeah. And I think one other thing that I would say and point people to in case of a, in resources is that one of the things that my wife and I really looked at and practiced a lot was nonviolent communication. And if you haven't heard that or know it about it, it's Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wrote a book and it's incredible. And I think it's really great at helping you on the emotional intelligence journey of being able to process feelings and understand feelings for what they are and making, you know, requests and understanding and identifying needs and being able to feel confident in addressing concerns you may have, like, but doing it in a calm kind of manner inside your relationship that leads to more positive outcomes in my experience.
Yeah, completely. Again, the book is When Your Partner Says Me Too, Your Role and Responsibilities in Your Recovery Process. Sean, this has been amazing having you here. Before I let you go, do you have time for a quick game?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's play.
Let's do it. So this is a game I call Red Flags. It's really simple. Do you know how red flags work?
In the context, well, you'll have to give me the context, because in the context of relationships, then yes. And, you know, there's also some other different red flags, but yeah, if we're doing it in terms of relationships. Yeah.
Well, it's basically that. So I'm going to give you a situation. They could be silly. They're mostly just silly. But you just tell me if they're a red flag for you or not.
Okay. For me. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Personally. All right. First thing, they are a high powered lawyer, but they are always on their phone.
Red flag.
Red flag.
High powered lawyer. Red flag.
Just that part. No, thank you. No lawyers. Those are all evil. Lawyers are all evil.
But the always on the phone though. Yeah, it's totally red flag for sure.
Yeah, if it wasn't the first one, it'd be the second one. Number two, they snort ketamine and they really want you to try.
In the right context, I think it probably wouldn't be a red flag. I think there's definitely some beneficial, you know, there's some clinics opening up that really look at ketamine's effect on mental health. I would say the red flag is probably using it in a recreational setting where, you know, kind of dosage isn't and set and setting isn't being considered. That would be, I think, the red flag for me, not the use of ketamine, but the setting in which it is being used and the dosage, I think, would be the red flag for me.
I think so too. I have a friend, my friend Devana, and he's been on the show a couple times in a previous show of mine. He had actually done the ketamine therapy at one point. He raved about it. He was like, this is great. I've never tried it. I did try it for the first time. Unfortunately, it was an accident. I'm not sure if I want to share this story, but fuck it, who cares? I thought I was snorting Molly at the time, and a friend of mine accidentally gave me ketamine. I wasn't
wildly Wildly different. Okay.
Wildly different. I was a little surprised. I was like, this, I thought it'd be completely different from what I experienced, but I was like, oh, well, this is my first time doing ketamine. Cool. Got it.
Yeah. They gave my mom ketamine in the hospital when she broke her leg. And my mom did not like the experience whatsoever. She's not really a psychedelic, she's not a super fan of psychedelics, which I thought was kind of funny that I was just picturing my mom just in the hospital, on this like journey. And I was like, the set and setting of that was just not exactly what you would want the journey to be or start like. But yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting, interesting drug.
For sure.
Number three, they have resting dumb face.
That's a tough one. it's probably a red flag for me in terms of if we're talking like get into a relationship with them, because I think it might cause problems in terms of like, is that something that I'm going to be able to live with for a long period of time? Like, I don't know.
I will have to look at your face and if I have to think that you're dumb every time I look at you.
might be an issue. Right.
they don't cover their face when they sneeze.
Oh, absolute red flag. Yeah. I don't know why that it probably wasn't a thing prior to 2019, but for some reason now, like I'm just like, I spot it so often where people are out in public and they cough and sneeze without, and I'm just like, it's just one of those things that now it's like, yeah, it's completely, and it may be a weird OCD thing now for me, but yeah, that's a red flag.
I waited tables for a long time. And I remember at my last job, I was, I sneezed, but I was nowhere near a table. I was like in the corner and I went like this into my elbow. And my friend that was standing right next to me was like, that guy was just staring you down for sneezing. I was like, I didn't do anywhere near him.
Yeah, for real. And I think that sneezing is, it's one of those things. It's like, if they do that as a habit, it's a red flag. But I think, sneezes have always caught, I think we've all been caught off guard by a sneeze or something, right? And just, it just kind of happened. But yeah.
Last one I have for you. They say they are from Kronos and they speak Klingon.
Ooh. I don't think it's a red flag. I think I'm curious now. I think they got stories. They are definitely, they're definitely going to have some trivia knowledge. So I think they're probably going to, they're going to be a teammate on trivia night for sure.
I agree. They'd be a really great bar trivia buddy. Awesome. Sean, thank you again for being here. It was so good having you. Thank you for
the awesome opportunity.
Conversation. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, really
again, the book is, where can my listeners find you?
SeanHamilton.com, SeanHamilton.com, and on Instagram and Facebook at Real Sean P. On socials.
And check out that book. When your partner says me too, your role and responsibilities in the recovering process.
Thanks again, Demi.
Thank you. A very special thank you to my guests for joining me in this week's episode. Check out the episode description for all of their information. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a comment and a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It'll really help out the show. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel for video versions of this show and other content. You will find my blogs, The Deviant Diaries, and A Deviant's Guide to Sex, show notes, articles used, and Hookup Horror Stories official merch on my website at DimitriWild.com. You can also purchase both of my poetry books, Bitter Blue Pill, and All Was Nothing in the Time of Champions from Amazon.com. Just search for Dimitri Wild. Oh, one last thing. Thank you for listening. Stay deviant.
Remember, subscribing might not be worth it, but it's also not optional. So just do it.